Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and we're diving into the heat. This is the transformation of paradigms as we started off kind of late June, early July, when they were just broaching this concept of admitting new states into the Union. Now we're halfway into July, July 14th, and the admission of new states. Mr. Gary, we just kind of covered this yesterday, but it's good to, you know, kind of retrace those grounds or those comments as we kind of move forward. So let me repeat, probably for the third time, what Mr. Gary said. Mr. Gary wished before the question should be put to the attention, or put that the attention of the House might be turned to the dangers apprehended from the Western states. He was for admitting them on liberal terms, but not for putting ourselves into their hands. They will, if they acquire power, like all men, abuse it. They will oppress commerce and drain our wealth into the Western country. To guard against these consequences, he thought it necessary to limit the number of states to be admitted into the Union in such a manner that they should never be able to outnumber the Atlantic states. He accordingly moved, quote, that in order to secure the liberties of the states already confederated, the number of representatives in the first branch of the states which shall hereafter be established shall never exceed in number the representatives from such the states as shall accede to this confederation. Now, he didn't add the close quote, but that had to have been the close quote right there. Now, Mr. King, Rufus King of Massachusetts, Mr. Gary of Massachusetts. So, Mr. King, I don't know. I don't think, and I never considered Rufus King a sycophant, but he quickly seconded it. Because, keep in mind, folks, Massachusetts was, I don't want to say max capacity, but there wasn't a lot of opportunity for the lifestyle that you needed to live and the land available. Most people had to go elsewhere. You can kind of live and split the property you have with your family, you know, the inbreeding type of thing. I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just how cultures kind of just, you know, stay where they are. But for new people coming to America, or people looking for a greater opportunity than, you know, staying at home or staying, you know, confined because of the constraints of the local community, those who really want to, you know, reach out, stretch out, and so forth, then they would have to go west. So Mr. King seconded this motion. Mr. Sherman of Connecticut thought there was no probability that the number of future states would exceed that of the existing states. If the event should ever happen, it was too remote to be taken into consideration at this time. Besides, we are providing for our posterity, for our children and our grandchildren, who would be as likely to be citizens of new Western states as of the old states. On this consideration alone, we ought make no discrimination as was proposed by the motion. Ah, now it's not like, you know, the middle states were going to be occupied by people who weren't, you know, akin to or had an attachment to the Union. In other words, I didn't see the need for, you know, the Russians out of Europe to migrate, and or I would say the Mohammedans to migrate, or any other, you know, nation outside of this small I'll just say the UK, the northern European nations. For some reason, the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Mediterraneans. Now, I take that back because the Italians, there were Italians that migrated. But for the most part, it was just Europe. And it wasn't like the numbers were coming in. I mean, they were coming in somewhat seemingly great. As a matter of fact, I'll give you a case in point. Something that actually amazed me because I just learned about the numbers of Nauvoo, Illinois, around the time of, you know, prior to the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln. The city or the town of Nauvoo exceeded the population of Chicago in just a matter of a couple of years. And this was done because of a massive migration of Mormons that went into that area. And so this kind of shows how, I don't want to call it a frenzy, but this focus, migration of people coming here for religious purposes from all over the world, were, I mean, they were just gravitating towards that. And the reality is, and the reason why the Nauvoo was not heavily populated today or very long is because the Illini, or the people of Illinois, drove them out. So I would encourage anybody to go read what happened and how that happened and understand the concepts of America and the concepts of, you know, what we actually got out of the Constitution. How did that even happen? How did one that mass migration occur, and why was that mass migration considered, you know, unacceptable and actually where people got away with violating the rights and the laws by driving them out and so forth? I mean, you know, we've made our share of mistakes as Americans. And, you know, when we see how we've behaved, is somehow we lost, because I was just talking to my wife about this. You know, America was initially founded on the very liberal concepts of enlightenment and, you know, how to make society better. And as soon as, you know, okay, and this is what happens with people. Well, they've worked really hard. They've created this. Okay, it's not necessarily the best, but it's as good as it's going to get, and we're going to keep it this way, and we don't want to make changes to it. What? Had we maintained enlightenment, I believe America would be in a completely different position, and the world would be in a completely different position. Had we maintained enlightenment, and had we eradicated slavery, had we done so many things differently, right? Hindsight being 2020. Where would the world be? Would we have had less wars? Would we have more prosperity? And would we have, you know, better, I don't want to say equity, but would we have better circumstances for all mankind? You know, hate to get religious because, you know, it's the middle of the week, right? I mean, you know, it's been a long time since we had Sunday school. Forgive me, I've trying to be funny. So my point is that when we kind of look at, you know, the goal of societies and the goal of the United States and in creating, you know, this land of liberty and so forth, and we look at the scriptures, and the scriptures say, you know, that the poor you'll always have. There will always be people that, you know, have been hit with hard times, or there's, you know, those who have to endure, just whether they be infirmed, whether they just be old and incapable of providing for themselves or what have you. A great society only is a great society if it's compassion, if the bowels of compassion are filled for those in need. And so because we've allowed our blinders to be created via I'll call it demographics, whether that be, you know, race, whether that be culture, whether that be whatever demographic, right? Not one of us. This is the bane of those who occupy this land. Not one of us. And we have a problem. Until we overcome these types of paradigms, we're not going to be ready to get to that next level. But I truly believe America was on that path. We could have gotten there. But way too many people. And the real problem that they had was that there was too few people that were educated. Education definitely needed to improve, and they were working on that. And they were working in lots of ways. But bottom line, the affluent and the plan of moving this global governance, the charter, the Illuminati, and their plan of basically destroying the religions and governments of the world was moving forward. While we were trying to create this, I don't want to say utopian government, but the closest thing to that that's ever been established. And look at where we are today. We're now the most oppressed nation by its own government. I had a conversation this past weekend with a gentleman that, you know, is completely oblivious. I mean, we were talking about, you know, government, you know, abuses, laws, and so forth. Actually, we were talking about big tech and how big tech is getting away with murder, literally. And, you know, figuratively and literally. And I was, you know, kind of going down this path, and his comment was, well, you'd think the federal government would be all over that. And I had to kind of, you know, get him to realize that that's the problem. It's not just big tech, you know, just getting away with murder, but they're being enabled by. And so I helped them start to see and understand that we're at a point, you know, where the government has been doing things that would be classified as warfare tactics against their own population. And so I gave him, you know, because I cited that letter that I wrote to the state legislatures January 23rd in 2023. And how, you know, here are the different classifications of warfare tactics that our own government is waging against we the people. And as he thought about that, he goes, really? And I kind of gave him the idea of economic warfare, of how our government has been waging warfare and harming the states, but not harming the people per se, other than creating them into being slothful, into not being able to maintain and keeping up, you know, their talents, their skills, their hardware, and so forth, to where things started rusting. I mean, when you're a farmer and you stop farming and your tractors just kind of sit idle, then they rust over, they don't run, things don't work as well. So when the subsidies kind of stopped and the farmers couldn't pay for their property taxes and all these other things, then what? I mean, these things were brought on by unconstitutional subsidies. We look at, you know, the warfare and the decimation of the heartland of America and different multiple markets because of government manipulation. I hate to tell you folks, but they've been attacking us in telling us that we're doing this for your own good. You know, this is better. It's better for the world, not for us. This is why I go out of my way to tell you that the states need to be driving the strategy, and they're not, because they have no control over the Senate, and we have no boundaries for the federal government. They're literally doing anything, and they're doing the bidding for the globalists. Anyway, let me move back into this. So Mr. Sherman basically, you know, he basically opposed this idea of, you know, creating an advantage for the eastern states. And he said, On this consideration alone, and this is his final comment I just read, on this consideration alone, we ought to make no such discrimination as was proposed by the motion. So Mr. Gary comes back, who started this, and says, if some of our children should remove, others will stay behind. And he thought it incumbent on us to provide for their interest. There was a rage for immigration to the eastern states, to the western country, and he did not wish those remaining behind at the mercy of the immigrants. Besides, foreigners are resorting to that country, and it is uncertain what things may make there. Or let me reread that. And it is uncertain what turn things may take there. I'm sorry. On the other question for agreeing on the motion of Mr. Gary, it passed in the negative. In other words, it didn't pass. Massachusetts said yes. Connecticut said yes. And then New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania divided. Delaware said yes. Maryland said yes. And then Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. And Georgia, no. So you had 4-5. And the no's held. And so the idea of creating that advantage was scuttled. And so we go back down later on that same day towards the end. And it kind of stews. The conversation stews. And Mr. Madison jumps in and expressed his apprehensions that if a proper foundation of government was destroyed by substituting an equality in place of proportional representation, no proper structure or superstructure could be raised. If the small states really wish for a government armed with the powers necessary to secure their liberties and to enforce obedience on the larger members as well as on themselves, he could not help thinking them extremely mistaken in their means. He reminded them of the consequences of laying the existing confederation on improper principles. All the principal parties to its compilation joined immediately in mutilating and fettering the government in such a manner that it has disappointed every hope placed on it. He appealed to the doctrine of and arguments used by themselves on a former occasion. It had been very properly observed by Mr. Patterson that representation was an expedient by which the meeting of the people themselves was rendered unnecessary, and that the representatives ought therefore to bear a proportion to the votes of their constituents, if convened, would respectively have. Was not this remark as applicable to one branch of representation as the other? But it had been said that the government would be in its operations be partly federal, partly national, and although in the latter respect the representatives of the people ought to be in proportion to the people, yet in the former it ought to be according to the number of states. If there was any solidity in this distinction, he was ready to abide by it. If there was none, it ought to be abandoned. In all cases where the general government is to act on the people, let the people be represented and the votes be proportional. In all cases where the general or where the government is to act on the states as such manner, in like manner as Congress now acts on them, let the states be represented and the votes be equal. This was the true ground of compromise, if there was any ground at all. But he denied that there was any ground. He called for a single instance in which the general government was not to operate on the people individually. The practicability of making laws with coercive sanctions for the states and political bodies had been exploited on all hands. He observed that the people of the large states would in some way or other secure to themselves a weight proportioned to the importance accruing from their superior numbers. If they could not effect it by proportional representation in the government, they would probably accede to no government, which did not in great measure depend on its efficacy in their voluntary cooperation, in which case they would indirectly secure their object. The existing Confederacy provided that the acts of the general government would be executed by the particular governments. The latter had a weight in proportion to their importance. No one would say that either in Congress or out of Congress, Delaware had equal weight with Pennsylvania. If the latter was to supply 10 times as much money as the former, and no compulsion could be used, it was of 10 times more importance that she should be voluntarily furnish the supply. In the Dutch Confederacy, the votes of the province were equal, but Holland, which supplies almost about half of the governed half of the money that governs the whole republic, he enumerated that the objects against an equality of votes in the second branch, notwithstanding the proportional representation in the first, the minority could negative the will of the majority of the people. Two, they could extort measures by taking them a condition to assent to the necessary measures. And three, they could obtrude measures on the majority by virtue of the particular powers which would be vested in the Senate. And four, the evil, instead of being cured by time, would increase with every new state that would be admitted, as they must all be admitted on the principle of equality. Five, the perpetuity it would give to the preponderance of the northern states against the southern scale was a serious consideration. It seemed now to be pretty well understood that the real difference in interests lay not between the large and small, between the northern and the southern. The institutions of slavery and its consequences formed the line of discrimination. There were five states on the south, eight on the northern side. Should a proportional representation take place, it was true the northern side would still outnumber the other, but not in the same degree at this time, and every day would tend towards an equilibrium. And so he kind of points out that as the way they stand already, now putting aside the new states coming into the Union, as the way they were already, the southern states or the northern states saw that the southern states created this disadvantage because they were going to perpetuate across the west because they had the greatest expanse. I pointed this out several days ago, if not a week or two, that the Virginia, Carolinas, and Georgia had stripes that went all the way across the United States to the Pacific Ocean. In other words, that was considered their territory. When they go into this union, they would secede that. They would no longer, that would not be their state. Their state would be based on those boundaries, and that the new territories coming out of those areas would be admitted as new states. And so, again, even though they're not the same state, they saw that the adding these states across that stripe of land was going to give them a considerable advantage. Now, all things being equal, you know, they were working in a vacuum with very limited information, and they had no idea what was coming around the corner, nor did they see things like the Missouri Compromise and how things were going to turn. But as things went through this convention, by the time they signed the document, they created a system that actually provided the checks and balances that they were looking for, and it actually put them on a path that was going to annihilate or basically make slavery in America extinct. So, or obsolescence, slavery be obsolete. So, the point is that they had no idea the corruption that was going to happen. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we move, because we kind of wrapped up for July, what was that, 14th, 15th, middle July. So now we move down to August 5th. And actually, I think it was August 4th, because the 5th would have been the Sunday, so I think it was Saturday. Anyway, and as a matter of fact, I can look real quick, and it was July 26th was the last day they convened. At least his notes cover that. So this was on July 26th. And so the next day they convene after this is August 6th. So what happens, or I should say, as a body of the whole, the next day they convene as a body of the whole. So what happened was they brought forth this, what they call the detail committee, created their recommendation for what was to be in the Constitution. And so it goes through all of these resolutions, right? And so boom, resolved, boom, resolved, boom, resolved. And so as they go through these things, they cut to the point of admitting new states into the Union. And this is how it's now formed, because we already covered it earlier that they wanted to have limitations. This is 7, or 8 actually, Roman numeral 8, resolved that the original formation of the legislature of the United States, the first branch thereof, shall consist of 65 members, of which number, and then they go through the listing of what state gets representation. Now, I believe Madison wanted to increase it to that, but they finally settled on 65. And then it goes on and says, so he goes through all the numbers, then Georgia gets 3. But at the present situation, the states may probably alter the number of their inhabitants. The legislature of the United States shall be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case of any states shall hereafter be divided or enlarged by addition of the territory. Now, this is some real legalese trickery right here that they included in this to kind of protect themselves. And what I want you to understand is that the apportionment is hard fixed in the current Constitution to 30,000, period. Every 30,000 citizens have the right of representation by one representative in the House of Representatives, and at a minimum, each state shall have at least one representative. So that means that a state that has more than 30,000 representatives is entitled to a second representative. Okay? So Wyoming should have a lot more, but again, we got to go back to the amendment and so forth. But let me reread this. But at the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, the legislature of the United States or Congress shall be authorized from time to time to apportion, to change the number of representatives. And in cases of such states shall hereafter be divided or enlarged by addition of territory, or any two or more states united, or any new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature of the United States, Congress, shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provision hereafter mentioned, namely, provided always that representation ought to be proportioned accordingly to direct taxation and in order to ascertain the alteration in the direct taxation, which may be required from time to time by the changes in the relative circumstances of the states. And then I'm just adding this too. Resolved that a census be taken within 6 years from the first meeting of the legislature of Congress of the United States, and once within the term of 10 years afterwards, of all the inhabitants of the United States, in the manner and according to the ratio recommended by Congress in the resolution of April 18th, 1783, and that the legislature of the United States shall apportion the direct taxation accordingly. Okay? So they kind of threw that out there. Then, in this same body of resolutions, they do this, and they say this. This is Roman numeral 17. Resolved that provisions ought to be made for the admission of states lawfully arising within the limits of the United States, whether from a voluntary junction of government or territory, or otherwise with the consent of a number of voices of the national legislature, Congress, less than the whole. And then 18, that a republican form of government shall be guaranteed to each state, and that each state shall be protected against foreign and domestic violence. And I say stick because that's how it was spelled out, S-T-I-C-K. Anyway, so that was actually laid out. And you know that just kind of created, like, it was like kicking the hornet's nest because they started really thinking about this. And along with a lot of other things, because they were constantly juggling back and forth between, you know, paper currency, money, and all of that. And so when we get into August 6th, they kind of cover electors, which we've already covered already, and then they get into the admission of new states. And this is what is said. Now, this has changed. Remember, they were all these different Roman numerals. Now it says section 4, as the proportions of numbers in different states will alter from time to time, as some of the states may hereafter be divided, as other states may be enlarged by addition of territory, as two or more states may be united, as new states be erected within the limits of the United States, the legislature, Congress, The legislature shall in each of these states regulate the number of representatives by the number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter made at the rate of one for every 40,000 people. So in other words, they will regulate it. The state legislatures will regulate where that representation goes. Okay? And then they come up again and they go back to 17. And let me see here. Yep, am I covering the right? Nope, you know what? I've got to go down a little bit further to get to the next admission of states. So they actually go on and they meander through all the different topics. And I'm going back down to, I'm sorry about this. These are long. I mean, we include, as you look at the navigation pane, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. We go through and talk about the admission of new states, and the admission of new states then comes up again on the 18th. So half a month goes by before they really want to tackle the admission or before they substantially dive into this with any real meat. And so this is kind of a lot. Now, this what we're showing you, and I actually showed you this before, this is when they kind of present the enumerated powers, what they're actually putting into Article 1, Section 10. This is the list of enumerated powers. Why is this important? because they inserted the admission of new states into this. Now, I could just tell you that that's what they did, but I want to read it to so you understand how it was done. So Mr. Madison submitted, in order to be referred to the Committee of the Detail, the following powers as proper to be added to those of the General Legislature, Congress, quote, to dispose of the unappropriated lands of the United States, quote, to institute temporary governments for new states arising therein, quote, to regulate affairs with the Indians as well as within the limits of the United States. These are powers. These were all being added into the enumerated powers. Okay? To, quote, to exercise exclusive legislation authority over the seat of government over the District of Columbia not to exceed 10 square miles, blah, blah. And then, quote, to grant charters of incorporations in cases where the public good may require them and the authority of a single state may be incompetent. In other words, the federal government is going to have the power to create corporations and incorporate things. That's what it was listed there. They were going to give them that ability. Then, quote, to secure to literary authors, and I know I covered all of this, and then we go down, and I believe I covered this as well, to fix and permanently establish the seat of government of the United States, which they shall possess the exclusive right of soil of jurisdiction, and go on and on and on. So that happened on August 18th, where they were actually delineated, and I wanted to highlight that part, that they had the ability. This was a power. Now, I told you on Monday that this is not in the powers. This is a responsibility, so it was demoted out of a power and moved as a congressional responsibility that they had. They didn't have any powers. This was something that was their responsibility. The states didn't have to bother about adding new states to the union. They left that to Congress as a responsibility, not a power. It was not enumerated. They removed it from there. It was there, and then they pulled it out because they wanted to make sure that it was not, you know, an addition. They wanted to limit the powers that they actually had. So anyway, we went through the 22nd already, and I hope you really enjoyed that because that was very insightful as to how this nation was moving forward and how they actually started settling the slavery issue. And so now we're kind of caught up to where we were. I just wanted, what we did was we retraced some of these things that we kind of skipped or I missed because this admission of states and state sovereignty in America is key. Look at Article 5 and the Amendment Protection Clause that secures the equal suffrage of the state legislature in the Senate. That's how important. They made it in Article 5. They placed an Amendment Protection Clause that state legislatures could not lose their suffrage, their equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. Which means that the 17th Amendment only changed the mode of how senators were to be selected. It did not touch the state's suffrage, and yet the states have completely lost their suffrage. And the only way and the best way to go back to and get rid of and rescind the 17th Amendment, which actually came up in one of the conventions. I received a text that they were talking about, you know, what to do about the 17th Amendment. So anyway, on admission of states, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania moved to strike out the last two sentences, to wit, quote, if the admission be consented to, the new states shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states, but the legislature may make conditions with new states concerning the public debt, which shall be then subsisting, close quote. He did not wish to bind down the legislature to admit Western states on the terms here stated. Mr. Madison opposed the motion, insisting that the Western states neither would nor ought to submit to a union which degraded them from an equal rank with other states. Big. I hope you realize just how big that is. And so Colonel Mason basically followed in kind and said this. And this is what Colonel Mason said. If it were possible by just means to prevent immigrations to the Western country, it might be a good policy. But go the people will as they find it in their interest, and the best policy is to treat them with that equality which will make them friends, not enemies. Mr. Governor Morris did not mean to discourage the growth of the Western country. He knew that to be impossible. He did not wish, however, to throw the power into their hands. Mr. Sherman was against the motion for fixing equality of privileges by the Constitution. Mr. Langdon was in favor of the motion. He did not know, but circumstances might arise which would render it inconvenient to admit new states on terms of equality. Mr. Williamson was for leaving the legislature free. The existing small states enjoy an equality now, and for that reason are admitted into the Senate. This reason is not applicable to the new Western states, and on Governor Morris's motion for striking it out, they took a vote. And New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut yes, and New Jersey yes, Pennsylvania yes, Delaware yes, Maryland no, Virginia no, and everybody else said yes. So in other words, the sentiments of the convention at this point in time was moving forward that they were going to create a disadvantage for the states when they came into the Union. And so this is how the debate continued. So they weren't done. They carried on and said, Mr. Martin and Mr. Governor Morris moved to strike out Article 17, but to such admission of the consent of two-thirds of the members present shall be necessary before any question was taken on this motion. Mr. Governor Morris moved the following proposition as a substitute for Article 17, or actually the, 17. Quote, new states may be admitted by the legislature in this union, by Congress, but no new states shall be erected within the limits of the present states without the consent of the legislature of such states as well as the general legislature. The first part of the union was inclusive and agreed to without any contest. Now, as we move forward, they basically say Mr. Martin opposed the latter part. Nothing, he said, would so alarm the limited states as to make the consent of the large states claiming Western lands necessary to the establishment of new states. Within their limits, it is proposed to guarantee the states. Shall Vermont be reduced by force in favor of the states claiming it? Franklin and Western County of Virginia are in a like situation. On Mr. Governor Morris's motion, the substitute, etc., was agreed to. No, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, yes. Carolina, yes. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So the yeses carried. So the motion was actually agreed to. So, in other words, they kind of undid that because they didn't want to create this disfavor for Vermont. And so it's kind of interesting how this was playing out. But, you know, they obviously had these affinities for the states that they were creating, Vermont being one of them, from New Hampshire. Mr. Sherman was against it. He thought it unnecessary. The union cannot dismember a state without its consent. Mr. Langdon thought that there was great weight in the argument of Mr. Luther Martin, and that the proposition substituted by Mr. Governor would excite dangerous opposition to the plan. Mr. Governor Morris thought, on the contrary, that the small states would be pleased with the regulation as it holds up to the idea of dismembering the large states. Mr. Butler, if the new states were to be erected without the consent of the dismembered states, nothing but confusion would ensue. whenever taxes should press on the people, demagogues would set up their schemes of new states. And so this is kind of interesting how this is actually peeling back their control or their desire of control. So here we go. Dr. Johnson agreed in general with the ideas of Mr. Sherman, but was afraid that the clause stood, Vermont would be subject to New York contrary to the faith pledged by Congress. He was of the opinion that Vermont ought to be compelled to come into the Union. Mr. Langdon said his objections were connected with the case of Vermont. If they were not taken in and remain exempt from taxes, it would prove of great injury to New Hampshire and the other neighboring states. Mr. Dickinson hoped the article would be agreed to. He dwelt on the impropriety of requiring the small states to secure the large ones in their extensive claims of territory. Mr. Wilson, when the majority stated this, when the majority of a state wish to divide, they can do so. The aim of those in opposition to the article, he perceived, was that the general government should abet the minority and by the means divide a state against its consent. Mr. Governor Morris, if the force division is the object of the new system and is to be pointed against one or two states, he expected the gentlemen from these would pretty quick leave us, and then they had to adjourn for the day. So they went off and did whatever they did. And the next day was August 30th. Now, they're really, folks, they're almost done. The Constitutional Convention is almost closed. And now they're going through the Constitution, and at this point in time, they've made some of these adoptions and some of these changes, and I think the Constitution by this point is starting to actually form into the seven articles instead of all of these massive articles. But anyway, Mr. Carroll moved to strike out much of the article as required the consent of the state to its being divided. He was aware of the object of this prerequisite might be to prevent domestic disturbances, but such was our situation with regard to the Crown lands and the sentiments of Maryland on that subject. He perceived he would, again, be at sea if no guard was provided for in the right of the United States to back the lands. He suggested that it might be proper to provide that nothing in the Constitution should affect the right of the United States to lands seceded by Great Britain in the Treaty of Peace, and proposed a commitment to a member from each state. He assured the House that this was a point of most serious nature. It was desirable above all things that the act of the convention might be agreeable to unanimously, but should this point be disregarded, he believed that all risks would be run by a considerable minority sooner than give their concurrence. Mr. L. Martin seconded the motion for a commitment. Mr. Rutledge, is it to be supposed that the states are to be cut up without their own consent? The case of Vermont will probably be particularly provided for. There could be no room to fear that Virginia or North Carolina would call on the United States to maintain their governments over their mountains. Mr. Williamson said that North Carolina Mr. Williamson said that North Carolina was well disposed to give up her western lands, but attempts at compulsion was not the policy of the United States. He was for doing nothing in the Constitution in the present case and for leaving the whole matter in status quo, as is. Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania was against the commitment. Unanimity was of great importance, but not to be purchased by the majority yielding to the minority. He should have no objection to leave the case of new states as heretofore as heretofore, he knew of nothing that would give greater or juster alarm than the doctrine that a political society is to be torn asunder without its own consent on Mr. Carroll's motion for commitment. New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, yes. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, yes. Maryland, yes. Virginia, no. The Carolinas and Georgia, no. So, I mean, it didn't carry. So Mr. Sherman moved to postpone the substitute for Article 12 agreed to yesterday in the order to take up the following amendment. Quote, the legislature shall have the power, Congress shall have the power to admit states into the Union and new states to be formed by the division or junction of states in the Union and to the consent of the legislature of such states. Close quote. The first part was meant for the case of Vermont to secure its admission. On the question, it passed in the negative. New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. And all the rest of the states, no. So in other words, what they were asking for wasn't passing. So Dr. Johnson moved to insert the words, quote, hereafter formed or, close quote, after the words shall be, or quote unquote shall be, in the substitute for Article 17, the more clearly the to save Vermont as being already formed into a state from a dependence on the consent of New York to her admission. Now, as we kind of look at New Hampshire, Vermont, and all of that, I mean, I know New York is close. What they're trying to do is they're trying to keep New York, who actually had really nothing to do with, but the way the language of the Constitution is, because it's adjoining, the New York legislature could actually contravene and say, hey, you can't form this new state. So Governor General Morris moved to strike out the word limits in the substitute and insert the word jurisdiction. This also meant to guard the case of Vermont, the jurisdiction of New York not extending over Vermont, which was in the exercise of sovereignty, though Vermont was within the asserted limits of New York. On this question, New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, yes. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. And everybody basically said yes. So in other words, the magical term was jurisdiction in changing. So now New York, because Vermont really wasn't in their jurisdiction, then the state legislature couldn't get involved in stopping a new state from forming. Again, we're towards the very end, and look at all of the business. I mean, this is boom, 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 boom in going over new states in the Union. So, in admitting new states in the Union. So, we've still got more to cover, and they're clearly going several pages. So, we will be back tomorrow as we cover more of federal lands and the admission of states as sovereigns into the Union. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.